This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, the healthcare.gov fiasco and whether the Obama administration can fix it. Also, a White House official is fired after his anonymous Twitter account is exposed. Is this justice or a witch hunt? I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, 12 Years a Slave, the new movie based on the true story of a free black man forced into slavery. It's getting huge Oscar buzz. We'll weigh in. And then, Welcome to Night Vale, one of iTunes' top podcasts, is a simply told tale of a creepy little town.
A friendly desert community where the sun is hot, the moon is beautiful, and mysterious lights pass overhead while we all pretend to sleep. Welcome to Night Vale.
We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. Glitches, delays, mangled data. Just like a real insurance company, only worse. The fiasco of the Obamacare sign-up, and can it be fixed? Then, the goofus behind the vile NatSec Wonk Twitter account loses his White House job. Should there be mercy for such Twitter sinners? Joining me today in Washington is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hi, John.
Hello, David.
And from Colorado this week is Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
Healthcare.gov, the Edsel of websites, the Mitt Romney campaign of government ventures, has emerged from the shadows of the government shutdown into the bright light of day, then crumbled into dust, crumbled deathly into dust. The software designed by the federal government, or designed, I guess, by contractors paid by the federal government to enable Americans to learn about their healthcare options and to sign up for Obamacare has failed in almost every possible way that something can fail. Contractors have been testifying in Congress about the screw-ups that went into this. It now appears that this site was not tested from start to finish, from soup to nuts, until 2 weeks before it launched. It appears that there were just tons of problems evident to everyone throughout the process. People are pointing fingers at other people, so the contractors who are doing it are blaming the HHS officials who are in charge of it. HHS, I think, is holding contractors responsible. Various contractors are blaming other people. Meanwhile, it is just a catastrophe of the highest order, both for citizens and, as a political matter, for the president and his supporters. John, why has it been such a disaster? So what do we know about why it's been so bad?
Well, we still don't really know, and the stories change, and the extent and level of the disaster is still a moving picture. I just got off a conference call with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is the governmental organization that took the lead role, kind of shepherded this whole process. So there were 55 contractors, and they all kind of reported to CMS, as it's known, which is very complicating because in our world, CMS means a content management system, which...
Yes. That I read so many news stories with that confusion in my head.
And yet the content management system is what screwed up here in a sense. So it's all very woven in that fashion. So one of the things is they say, well, we didn't expect all this traffic. Well, okay, that's sort of true. But the traffic has been reduced and a lot of the problems aren't still fixed. So what were some of the problems? Some of the problems were you got there and you went to your state to even put in your first name and the thing crashed. Then there was a process where you could fill out your name, but then it got everything wrong, or somewhere in the process you'd get an error screen, or it would somehow put you in different fields. The reason this was supposed to be so great is that you were supposed to be able, in 5 or 10 minutes, figure out what kind of coverage you were available for, what kind of federal subsidy you would get, and start to begin making choices about your health care within 5 to 10 minutes.
And John, we should say that's why you had to identify yourself in the beginning, because they were trying to set it up so that you would be able to know how the exchanges related to you personally, because first they would identify you and verify your identification.
Right. And this is in part a sales effort, because in the wake of this disaster, a lot of the president's supporters say, well, you know, a website isn't the whole ball of wax here. And in that, they are right, except that the administration was banking a lot on this website. In fact, I wrote a story before it was launched based on conversations with administration officials on just how much they were banking on this website. Why? Because they were hoping that by making it super easy, that it would do two things. A, it would get people to sign up, and they want lots of people to sign up so that the insurance pools in these various states won't be overloaded with sick people, which would cause premiums to skyrocket. And also they wanted people to say, gee, this was such an easy and fun process. And look, I'm not paying very much money because I enter the information and I find out immediately I'm going to get a subsidy and therefore my premium is going to be really low. And so this is going to be awesome. And that would create an avalanche of social media stories that would get and reach out to these people who aren't likely to sign up for insurance. A lot of them younger people who are like, eh, you know, I'm invincible. I don't want to pay the fine. I don't want to sign up. I got other stuff to do. So that this kind of wave of stories that they would hear from all these different parts of their life would maybe then encourage them to go sign up. Of course, the stories they're now hearing are just the opposite.
So one of the things that seems so alarming about this, Emily, is this idea of the death spiral, which is that for any insurance market to flourish, there has to be a mix of healthy young people who don't really get sick, who aren't using the insurance very much, and the sick people who depend on it. But with a process that is so difficult, the fear is that the only people who are going to be willing to go through this process and get through the exchanges and actually register for insurance are people who desperately need it, people who are likely to use it, people who whose costs will be high, and that this will cause insurers to lose an arm and a leg and not to want to participate in the exchanges and for the exchanges to fail as a marketplace. Is this something that seems as alarming as economists make it out to be?
Well, I think if it really happens, it will be extremely alarming. I do think it's premature to decide that Obamacare exchanges are going into a death spiral because we have a whole bunch of months before people have to sign up. And if things are in this state of disarray technologically, the administration is going to have to delay the individual mandate. They just won't have a choice. I know they're not going to say that right now. I don't think they should say that. I think hopefully things get fixed. And if things get fixed by, you know, it seems like Thanksgiving, or maybe the end of Hanukkah. Hanukkah's really early this year. Then maybe that we could all still make the deadlines.
Do a lot of people track their insurance purchases by Hanukkah?
Well, I was going to say early December, and then it just seemed like a more interesting way to say that. Sorry, probably not. But anyway, I mean, it seems like right now this is teetering on the brink of a real serious problem, but it could still get fixed. I don't have to say that when you read the news reports about how messed up this system is, it doesn't inspire a lot of feelings that it's all going to be solved in time. On the other hand, I feel like having gone through some of these huge shifts, in a different way at Slate, when we've redesigned things back in the day before our current amazingly crackerjack tech team, we would have a lot of trouble and it felt incredibly frustrating, and then things would eventually work themselves out.
I would say two things. One, to your point, Emily, there is some evidence in the Massachusetts system, Massachusetts being the test case for all of this, that younger applicants or these invincibles rushed in at the last minute. In other words, if you were ever going to get them, you're going to get them in either December right before the January deadline or in February, March before the end of the open enrollment period. So if things can get fixed by then, that would be good. Although they have to get so many of these young invincibles that, you know, every day that goes by does kind of matter. One thing, though, that seems really weird about where we are now, one of the things they said is there was this huge deluge on the first day. Well, couple of things. One, some of the reporting suggests that deluge was mostly of just curiosity seekers, people who were not necessarily coming in to get the final product. And yet the process for those who want to get the final product, and I've talked to them, is broken down. So in other words, when we had problems at Slate, usually they could narrow the problem and some people would get service, or there would be some way to get a limited thing going forward. Here, at least in the way they explain it, even if you like winnow it down to a small number of people, it's still not working very well. And that's not just the website. What's also happening is the information as it gets translated from the website to the insurance companies. The insurance companies are having to hand check all the information that comes in, call people on the phone, write it down on paper to make sure that the information was translated effectively. And that suggests a systemic problem. And
fortunately, there are so few people who are managing to get through that they're able to do it.
That's right. The insurance company's like, oh, well, actually, it's no big deal because it's such a trickle.
Lining, David. Good job finding that one. I mean, what's so upsetting about this is, for me, and I'm sure for a lot of liberals, is feeling like the government took on this big project, part of showing that big government can work, that the government should have this kind of role in the health insurance market, is for the government to competently execute its website, which it made a big deal of and went around touting. And so that's really alarming. And the stories I'm now reading about what's messed up with the government procurement process and how basically it takes so much cumbersome effort and red tape to even get on the list to be considered for one of these big government contracts, these stories are really depressing. And they just take the air out of feeling like, oh, come on, yes, the government can succeed in endeavors like this.
I would also point out there is a ton of bad software that's released. You know, Microsoft is constantly delivering products that nobody wants to use or that are dated or done before anyone gets them. So it's not unusual to get something terribly wrong when you're dealing with software. It does happen.
It happens in the private sector as well, but it doesn't have the same kind of implications, and maybe they didn't spend $400 billion on it. Or is it million? Am I doing
million,
my usual
million.
Million to billion switch?
I want to turn us to the political implications here. So one argument that is making its way around, and certainly I think a lot of Democrats are comforting themselves with this, is isn't it good that Republicans didn't skip the shutdown and focus on this before? Because had they only just allowed Obamacare to unroll and fall apart rather than focusing everything on the shutdown, they would have made huge political gains. Do you think there's anything to that, John?
I kind of don't. I have another view, which is this festered for 3 weeks. While the shutdown was going on, the Republicans were getting hammered. But a lot of the press covered it as a phenomenon sort of untainted by politics. If it had been immediately a Republican hobby horse from the beginning, everybody would have fallen into the kind of predictable left-right back and forths, and it would have been framed that way. But when it comes out as just these are massive screw-ups, I wonder if that doesn't give it a less partisan cast and therefore make it worse for Democrats and better for Republicans, because it's a story that's about not Republicans overreaching, but it's a story about a thing being launched by the government and it being a total mess. So in that way, the fact that the Republicans were off having their adventure on trying to defund Obamacare allowed this to become a press story rather than a left-right story. I think also if this goes on for 2 more months, Obama has to delay this, his turns into death spiral starts, the party that's associated with trying to end Obamacare will look better than it did.
Oh my goodness,
this
you're
week.
So right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, the other thing I kept thinking was, oh, well, maybe the Republican shutdown craziness will distract everyone long enough for the government to fix Obamacare. But that has clearly not happened.
Coming up, a snarky anonymous Twitter account cost an Obama staffer his job. You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political Gabfest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. At Nat Sec Wonk was a Twitter feed that was run by, it now appears, someone named Yofi Joseph, who is a National Security Council staffer. He was a director, a relatively low-level position, but he was heavily involved in our strategies about nonproliferation with Iran and North Korea. This Twitter feed, which was run secretly for 2 years, became notorious among a small sector of foreign policy people for attacking the looks of various people in the foreign policy establishment and the media, for being incredibly nasty about Hillary Clinton and some of the people associated with Hillary Clinton, for making lots of lewd and sexually charged remarks about people. The same person, Joseph, may also be behind a Twitter feed about escort services. That hasn't been, I think, 100% confirmed yet. So when he was uncovered earlier this week after an investigation by the Daily Beast, I think, Joseph was cashiered at National Security Council, and everyone involved got really, really angry. And there was a lot of hand. What was there? There wasn't hand rigging. Was there hand rigging about Twitter? What is it? It was
there, there were grand conclusions. There were grand conclusions drawn about Twitter and the id and what the new line is for being. I mean, this guy's career is over. And then the question is, I'm riffing here.
Yeah.
The question is whether his career should be over and life should be over for. A couple questions. Should his life be over as a result of this behavior, A? B, does Twitter represent a special portal to the id that we are all just one dark path away from? Or is this guy actually just a jerk who did jerkholic things? Or C?
Let's stop on B for a minute.
Okay.
Because, John, you're a giant of Twitter. You're a titan of Twitter.
But please don't do so something like this. It would be so
but
sad.
But you've tweeted,
for all of
you've
us.
Probably, I didn't check your feed, but you've tweeted probably 20,000, 30,000 times, some insane number of times, right?
Yeah. How many
and every time you tweet, there is this moment where you must ask yourself, like, huh, I really wonder if I should tweet this.
No, because John doesn't write anything like this at all.
Well,
you might want to ask yourself that, since you tend to be a little more rash than John, and you also tweet.
I can't believe you said that, Emily.
If I was going to worry about one of you saying something irascible on Twitter, I would be more concerned about you.
Well, irascible, yes. But so I just want to know what John's id is like when he is tweeting. Do you ever have the sensation, like, I'm about to say something I shouldn't say? Or is your id compartmentalized?
Ego. That's true, not just of Twitter. The question, though, I guess, is this, which is, in any administration, these people exist. They are often sources to those of us who cover administrations. And one of the things that you have to do is know when you're dealing with somebody who feels like they should be further ahead in life, who feel like all their colleagues are idiots, and they say really volatile
things. Call those
people
human beings.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know the special cases, and this guy seemed like one of them, which is they just think they're the smartest person in the room, but yet they're not. And in the past, a lot of these folks would show up as blind quotes in stories, anonymous quotes in stories. And now you have a place where they can gain a certain kind of cachet because they have insider knowledge, which they can display in these tweets, but they're protected.
They gain anonymity.
By anonymity, in the way they would have been in a New York Times story. But, I mean, clearly they go, this guy, like, I mean, he just kind of got increasingly worse.
So it's okay for him to have the thought that Susan Rice's power suit is ludicrous and she's homely, if he wants to think that, right?
Sure, of course.
Yeah, okay. Is he allowed to write that in an email to his wife?
Yeah, as long as he thinks nobody's going to read the email.
What about an email to several friends?
Well, then you're just upping the ante of the risk every time you.
No, he means as a he means as a policy.
It's not about whether you can do it; it's about whether it's wise.
He means as a policy. I think as a manager, I think you can argue that once you do it outside of your own family, you're being disloyal. You're
fomenting rebellion.
Yeah, and you're just doing things that are bad for the general enterprise, and so you're toast.
So it's not Twitter in this. It's a community beyond the community of your absolutely nearest ones.
Right, and
right,
then Twitter being
a vehicle.
Huge
it's
example.
It's not just Twitter, but Twitter is the popular social media site that allows for easy anonymity, or actually more like the illusion of easy anonymity, because this guy, like so many of these people, ends up getting outed. And that's, I think, what you see, is that he was clearly in some way reveling in being the snarky insider with the, you know, NatSec wonk following that people are gossiping about in the hallways. And so he had this illusion of a different kind of invincibility from the people who won't necessarily sign up for health insurance, but some sense that he could do this anonymously but also enjoy the ride. And that's, I think, particular to this social media moment.
He didn't have that many followers. He was a bit of this is a super inside Washington story, but it's not unimportant in a broader sense because, as I said, these kinds of people exist. There are probably some in HHS right now who would like to be tweeting, geez, I remember that meeting 2 months ago when I said, we should probably test this thing because it's going to be a total disaster when we launch it.
And my boss said, don't worry about it. What do you know?
And so the question is then, is it ruinous to the enterprise if somebody tweeted things that are of news value and not of morale-busting value? And so would they get canned for that too? In other words, what if they were just—
That's a really
what if they
question.
Weren't
what do you think? What's the answer to that? They probably would, but they probably shouldn't, right?
Well, if you're tweeting what's happening inside confidential government meetings, that is a fireable offense. Absolutely. If you know—
David wants to fire us for it, ergo it must be fireable.
No, there wasn't—
Seriously. Like, if someone was doing that, you're a manager and a boss who actually has to worry about this stuff. You would not want that going on.
Here's a question, though. Does this make us more, just as a general public, are we bigger jerks? Or because we have to think about what we're going to say in public often, if you're engaged in social media, you're more engaged with your self-censoring, and therefore you're thinking more about the kinds of things that are possible to say out in public, and therefore you're thinking more about what's polite and what's good for the common experience.
So actually, this gets to something I want to talk about. One of the things that I think is quite sad about our era and about the real name push that we have, and the fact that anonymity is never anonymity anymore. So this guy was definitely going to get found out.
Yeah, but people believe in anonymity. They still have this misguided belief in it. That's the problem.
People have a misguided belief in it. But in general, the fact that anonymity is increasingly hard to get, Facebook doesn't permit it. Most commenting on a lot of sites doesn't permit it. There's a loss when you don't have anonymity.
Oh, God, I am so not with you on this one. There is a loss if you're like a political dissident in Syria. If you are in this country, almost all the time, there is a net gain for not having anonymous comments. We so err on the side of, oh, free speech everywhere, everywhere. Let's, you know, let people defame each other and not have any accountability for it. And I think that in free societies, that is generally a big mistake. And yes, you can make small exceptions for people who truly feel at risk, like victims of domestic violence are an example. But most of the time, it is much healthier discourse when people have to own up to what they are saying.
Most of the time, it's true. I would not argue with you that it's most of the time it's true. But I would say there are times when it's not true. There are times when people, for totally legitimate reasons, are afraid of the consequences for them. And sometimes are, you know, sometimes it's cowardly, but where they are able to speak out about something that they wouldn't be able to speak out with about if their real name was associated with it. And John's example of the healthcare one is a good one. What if someone had been flagging that, raising that to the public months and months ago?
But you just said that person legitimately should have been fired for that. You have to decide which side of this you're on. Are you thinking about it as the manager who is dealing
with disgruntlement
and potential troublemaking? Or are you thinking of it as, you know, the journalist who's almost always in favor of transparency?
I'm
excellently done,
no,
Emily.
No, that's not right. As the manager, as the person who employed that person should be fired.
We should make more opportunities for them to go around, and we should mourn the hypothetical imagined loss. These people have plenty of opportunities. They have outlets for this all over the place. We still allow anonymous commenting on Slate for reasons that are totally mysterious to me.
But who has plenty of outlets for it? I don't think if you're a government whistleblower, there are not plenty of outlets.
You can go on Facebook and make up an identity. I mean, most of the time, people do not get caught for making up their identities and hiding. That's why they keep doing it, because the odds of getting caught are very low.
So your view, this is funny, because I'm typically in my life, I'm a person who believes in all sorts of transparency. I've, you know, published my Social Security number and things like that.
And your telephone number, even.
Publish my telephone number, my license plate number, my home
address. Yeah, but you're also a free speech absolutist, and this view of yours goes with your free speech absolutism.
So your view is that there are never, Emily, there are never occasions where anonymity is
okay. I told you, Syrian dissidents and people who directly fear violence, yes. Those people, or, you know, if you're the subject of a story and you are bearing incredibly private information, and that was bearing without the E in it, and you are putting yourself at risk. So, yes, the journalist knows who you are, but you don't necessarily have to give your name. Fine. But if you are writing, you know, a string of expletives or snark on any social media site or commenting anywhere, we would be better off if you had to have your name on that before you posted.
I associate myself with the comments from the gentle lady from New Haven.
What bothers me about this subject is I think our general tendency here, and it's why we allow for so much defamation online. In this country, it's this kind of, to me, knee-jerk belief that more speech is always better. And in this case, you can argue that having all this anonymous, crappy speech is actually stifling. Think of all the online comment threads that just devolve into total trashing in a way that means that nobody normal wants to get involved with them. That's because we're allowing all this anonymous speech. There is a cost. There is a cost.
Okay, you guys have won.
Ooh, we vanquished you. Let's end.
No, you're not vanquished. We're done talking about it.
But yes, you can declare victory. That degree, that's fine.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics on the new revamped WNYC iPhone app. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, 12 Years a Slave, the new and quite harrowing film by British director Steve McQueen. And then we'll speak to the creators of the enormously popular podcast, Welcome to Night Vale. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steven.
Dana, I got to start with you. 12 Years a Slave is a the new movie from the director Steve McQueen, who I probably don't need to say but will say is not the car chase macho man. He's the British director known for the movies Hunger and Shame. His new film is based on a true story about Solomon Northrup, an African-American freeman who was snatched off the streets of Washington, sold into slavery in the 1840s. It's about, obviously, the 12-year round of torture and humiliation that he then suffers at the hands of various masters and overseers. Dana, this movie's getting an enormous amount of attention. It's a critical love. What do you think of it?
Well, I'm glad we're talking about it because I think I'm still processing this movie more than a week after seeing it. Steve, I know you just walked out of it, so you probably really don't have enough distance to analyze it that much. But I'm starting now to get into a mode where I am following conversations about it and analyzing it a bit. I think this is a very beautiful film. I mean, obviously, visually and orally, extraordinary, beautifully crafted, a very important film, something that deserves most of the accolades it's getting. There's something about its relationship to its audience that didn't quite sit right with me that I want to think through out loud with you guys. But I think on the whole, I'm a strong partisan of this movie.
I really want to hear the rest of that. That's really interesting. All right, cogitate for a moment while I turn to Julia Turner. Julia, this movie was a powerful experience to sit through. It couldn't leave anybody inert, but I'm just wondering which way it polarized you.
Which way did it polarize me? Well, Steve, it polarized me against slavery. Which, you know, I mean, I don't mean to be flip about it. It feels like the sort of movie you can't be flip about. It's incredibly powerful. I think the performances in it are really amazing, particularly Chiwetel Ejiofor, who plays Solomon Northrup, who becomes to be known as Platt during his time as a slave, is just an incredible entry point into the horrors of this world, and his face and the amount he is able to convey while not speaking and not talking and not expressing himself, which is a fundamental part of his experience as a slave, is just crucial to making the film as powerful as it is. But I also think I'm still reeling in the amorphous unprocessability of a film, you know, a fiction about this enormity. So why don't we cut to a clip and then we'll let Dana tell us what to think.
Days ago, I was with my family in my home. Now you tell me all is lost. Tell no one who I am. That's the way to survive. Well, I don't want to survive. I want to live.
That clip is Solomon on the slave boat that's carrying him ever further south towards slavery and towards imprisonment, conspiring with some other captors about how they might or might not get out of their situation.
Well, what I was going to say is I'm normally kind of allergic to morally important, self-consciously morally important movies, and I wasn't allergic to this one at all. Not at all. I thought it was incredibly powerful. I thought it was, you know, kind of urgent to go see it and felt as though it lived up to that sense of urgency. I do think that when you cram 12 years of torture and utter humiliation and dehumanization into 133 minutes, it makes the experience unrelentingly and brutalizing, which it should be. I'm not saying it shouldn't be, but it does make it a little bit tonally uniform, I think, to a degree. But what I will say about that is that, and I asked this naively, I really don't know the answer. Has a black director ever made a major movie about slavery, right? And one of the reasons I ask is that, you know, sure, okay, an hour into this, you're feeling battered a little bit. At the same time, you know, we're finally watching a movie in which the conscience of the good white person isn't the dramatic center of the movie, right? It's not really about how, you know, white people consult their own conscience and then through acts of moral heroism, you know, midwife the freedom of African Americans.
Right. This movie is the polar opposite of, for example, The Help.
Yes.
Which we talked
about.
It's
exactly the polar opposite.
But
of the
I think Help, you yeah. put your finger on something really interesting, Steve, which is that Steve McQueen is a black director, but he's a British black director.
British, yeah.
And another thing that a couple of folks have latched onto in talking about this film is the perhaps problematic fact that the slave whose perspective we're following is a free man.
Yeah.
You know, and I think some people are discussing, and I'm not quite sure where I come down on the question of, does it matter? Should we be troubled by the notion that we are, that this is not just a movie about just a slave who was born on a plantation and lives there for all of his or her days and then dies in, you know, abjectness, still a slave, that there's something about the fact that he was a free man, that he was a violinist, that he was able to make a living and have a life full of free will with his family, that is our entry point into the world of slavery, that this is a movie about an exceptional slave, a slave who shouldn't be a slave who wasn't meant to be there, mm-hmm. That should bother us. And I think there's an interesting parallel to with that, to the fact that the director is a British person and not an American person. It's sort of a British, a black British viewpoint, perhaps, of slavery. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of outsideness to it, which perhaps maybe lends the film some of its power. I mean, it's an American production. You know, we shouldn't make too much of it. It's not like, you know, the BBC put this film together, but there is an inflection of Britishness in it, maybe.
But I agree with you, but I do think that as long as this isn't the only story that's told, it is a story that needs to be told. And there's an extraordinary scene very early on in the movie with almost no dialogue, very little dialogue. He goes, while he's still a freeman and very bourgeois, he goes into a shop with a white proprietor with his wife, and the proprietor kind of smooth. They know each other quite well, treats him with an enormous amount of deference and respect, and sells his wife a kind of fancy handbag. And it's this amazing scene. And then another African-American man, young man, walks in almost like a zombie off the street, and he's just staring. They're in Saratoga, New York, and he's staring at Northrop, and you don't quite know what's going on. And then that person's master comes in, and clearly this person has traveled up from the South with his slave, and this African-American in bondage cannot process who this human being is, who this basically upper bourgeois African-American is, who's being treated like a human being by other white people. It just struck me, Dana, as a scene of pretty remarkable moral power with very little dialogue in it.
That's something that this film does exceptionally well. And we should mention here that it was not actually written by Steve McQueen. Give some credit to John Ridley, who wrote the screenplay. But something that it manages to do that I haven't seen any movies about slavery or race in general manage to do that are for a sort of a general audience, other than maybe a blaxploitation movie or something, is that it really takes seriously the relationships among the smaller characters, the slaves on the plantation who we don't necessarily get to know. It takes that social hierarchy seriously, as you mentioned in the store at the beginning, but also especially in the long middle segment, Alfre Woodard, who plays the neighboring mistress of a plantation owner who's giving advice to this younger woman who's being essentially raped daily by Michael Fassbender, by her owner. Alfre Woodard is sort of saying to her, well, you've got to play the angles, right? And essentially sort of saying, this is the best life you can hope for as a slave, to be the kept mistress, not acknowledging the abuse that the Patsy character, played by Lupita Nyong'o in another incredible performance, is suffering at her master's hands. So there's all those levels going on in that part that I thought were really beautifully observed.
Yeah, you're right to single out that performance, Dana, which is just completely incredible of Lupita Nyong'o as Patsy. But tell us, you tantalized us with the thing that troubles you about the movie or might be troubling you. Tell us.
Right. Yeah. I was going to respond to your question. Actually, the thing that you mentioned that seems to be a very common critique was not something that bothered me about the movie. And I'll address that first and then get to the thing that did bother me. And then you guys can maybe tell me if you sensed any of that as well. But as to this kind of exceptionalist critique and the idea that Solomon Northup's story is the wrong one to tell because he was an exceptional, educated, free African-American who was then abducted into slavery and that it was not a typical slavery story, you know, this exceptionalist critique was made of Schindler's List in almost identical form. I think it was actually Stanley Kubrick who said something about, you know, why did we hear the story of the 600 who lived and not the 6 million who died? And I think maybe at the time that Schindler's List came out, I don't know, because I was younger, because I was in grad school, I think that argument had a little bit more coherency or power for me than it does now. It seems too cruel to me to deny people, audiences, and readers a story. I mean, Solomon Northup's story is fascinating and horrific because it is exceptional, and he was able to tell it because he was educated. Yes, it's because of a series of accidents of history that slave narrative came down to us, but it's an incredible document that people should know about and makes an incredible story.
I also think Owen Gleiberman in his review for Entertainment Weekly made a really good point, which is that his exceptionalism serves a particular purpose in this movie, which is to make real the consciousness of all the slaves, which is that every person who is a slave knows at heart that they are free and should be free. Mm. And his narrative actualizes that and makes it literal and sort of legally true. But what's legally true for him is morally true for every single person on that plantation. So in a way, his experience is a metaphor for the larger experience and not some complete anomaly that is not pertinent or not relevant. I did not feel, I agree with you, Dana, that I do not agree with that critique.
Mm. Right.
All right. So give us, drop it on us. What is your critique?
Well, I mean, I guess it does have to do with the relationship that's set up between the viewer and the movie. I went into this movie with something of a bias against Steve McQueen. His two previous movies, while I found them incredibly artful, seemed to me both sort of at times a little bit basking in their own artfulness, and also, more significantly, to be sadistic toward the audience. Hunger, his first movie, which I remember primarily as the first time I saw Michael Fassbender in a movie, who is just a, you know, absolutely, he's like the crack of actors. I just find him so, right? He's impossible to stop watching. He's so kinetic.
Electric.
He's so handsome. He's so cruel and evil in this movie, but still just absolutely seductive in a horrific way. Anyway, I mean, to me, Steve McQueen has primarily been a delivery vehicle for Michael Fassbender until this movie, honestly. And watching Michael Fassbender's character, Bobby Sands, who was a real guy, an Irish hunger striker, slowly starve himself to death in hunger is a really horrible experience that I feel like Steve McQueen sort of openly finds delectation in parts of that movie. And so I found it a little bit morally queasy, that movie, in addition to being kind of sublimely beautiful and a great setting for Michael Fassbender's performance. Shame, there are other problems with. You can go read my review. I mean, I found it almost borderline laughable how seriously that movie took itself. And so I went into 12 Years a Slave fascinated by the subject matter, very curious about the performances, but fearing that Steve McQueen was going to bludgeon me again with horrors. And I come out still now, a week and a half after seeing it, not quite knowing whether I do think that he was too bludgeoning with the horror or not. I mean, of course, the argument could be made that, you know, he's, if anything, underrepresenting how awful things were for, you know, the mm-hmm. people whose stories he's telling. But at the same time, there's something about the gauntlet that he puts the viewer through that at times feels to me like, you will sit here and take this. Mm-hmm. For example, the whipping scene, which, you know, we won't, I guess, spoil, but I mean, there's a very, very brutal scene of the Patsy character being whipped. First by Michael Fassbender, then he forces Solomon Northup to whip her as well. And it goes on and on. And there was a little bit of a feeling to me of that the gore and the graphicness of that scene was, I don't know how to describe it except sadistic.
I see what you mean, Dana. I mean, I think this is where the little bell in my head of Steve McQueen being a Brit keeps dinging, because there is something that feels slightly complicated about his relationship at being outside American culture, making this movie within American culture to make real to Americans and to show them just how violent and horrible slavery was. But I felt like the unflinchingness of that violence did feel honest to me. I mean, it felt like, yeah, that's the problem with slavery, is that it didn't stop. It didn't cut away. It didn't cut to inside the plantation behind the white pillars where everything was nice and people drank out of China. Like, the whipping just continued. It seemed appropriate. And I think maybe not, I didn't see shame, but from what I understand, it's about a very, like, sad, wealthy, well-endowed man who's just so addicted to sex, he just has to keep banging Carrie Mulligan or something like that, and it's just so awful to be him. And I could see where a similar lingering on torment in that context would feel gratuitous and maybe perhaps make you distrust the motives of the director. But to me, coming fresh to see McQueen's work, I haven't seen Shame or Hunger, it felt appropriate.
All right. Well, the movie is 12 Years a Slave. It's getting a ton of accolades and some bickering as to its virtues. Go see it and tell us what you thought about it. Come to our Facebook page at facebook.com/culturefest. Coming up, welcome to Night Vale, a podcast that's part Lake Wobegon, part X-Files. You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner. And this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for things we mention on the program, we collect them on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, if you would, leave a comment while you're there. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. Okay, moving on. Welcome to Night Vale is a bi-monthly, or should we say, Julia Turner, fortnightly podcast about a fictional desert town, the town of Night Vale. We get to know Night Vale via an incantatory monologue in the form of a sort of newscast. Night Vale is a place where all conspiracy theories appear to be real. There are dog parks where no dogs are allowed, only hooded apparitions. And there's a glow cloud more or less constantly moving in from the west. The town's motto is, if you see something, say nothing. I suppose you could say it's Garrison Keillor for the L Train set, but it's oh so much better than that. The show is the inspired creation of Joseph Fink and Jeffrey Craner, a couple of Brooklyn blokes. And we scored. We have them in the studio today. Guys, we are so psyched to have you here. Congratulations on the total success of your podcast. It's just gone crazy viral in the last few months. Thanks for coming in to talk to us.
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Most people listening to us, I'm going to wager, have heard the show, but it's a very distinctive experience.
Yeah, what was that word you used to describe? Incantatory?
Incantatory.
Yeah, that was good.
I've never heard, like, I've heard a lot of words used to describe Night Vale. I've never heard that one. I'm very pleased to hear a new adjective thrown at it.
Incorporated into the show, I give you full license.
But fantastic.
For that tiny, vanishingly small portion of our audience that hasn't heard the incantatory uniqueness of Welcome to Night Vale, let's play a little clip and then we'll talk to its creators.
The city council announces the opening of a new dog park at the corner of Earl and Somerset near the Ralphs. They would like to remind everyone that dogs are not allowed in the dog park. People are not allowed in the dog park. It is possible you will see hooded figures in the dog park. Do not approach them. Do not approach the dog park. The fence is electrified and highly dangerous. Try not to look at the dog park, and especially do not look for any period of time at the hooded figures. The dog park will not harm you. And now the news.
I mean, you guys have just hit this perfect sweet spot where something that is just so, sounds so niche and sounds like it should just stay so niche is so perfectly itself that everyone is discovering it at the same time. It's really something unique. And I think what people would want to know is, how did you guys meet? First of all, it's not your voice on that recording, right?
Right. It's
no.
Cecil Baldwin, an actor friend of ours.
How did you guys meet? How did you come up with this? Where did Night Vale come from?
So I came up with Night Vale about, I guess, 2 years ago now.
Sure.
Let's say 2 years. So Jeffrey and I met through the New York Neo-Futurists, which are a downtown performance art group. Jeffrey, you can maybe talk a little more about them.
Sure. We do Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind every Friday and Saturday night. It's 30 plays in 60 minutes. But yeah, Joseph and I got to know each other through that. I was writing and performing plays with them, and Joseph and I began a relationship of talking about my writing and his writing and things like that.
Yeah, and then a couple years back, 2011, we wrote a play together that we performed in the St. Mark's Church in New York City. It was about time travel, kind of metaphorically and literally. And then I really enjoyed writing that with him, and I wanted to do something else. And I also really enjoyed podcasts, and I wanted to do one of those, but I didn't want to do any of the ones I was already listening to because they already existed. I was trying to find something that no one was doing. And so it took several months, but I came up with the idea of this little town where every conspiracy theory was just true, and then life just kind of went on from there, and no one cared. And so gradually, kind of in breaks between other things, I just wrote little paragraphs, little bits, and then I put together this pilot episode and approached both Jeffrey and Cecil with it.
I have a question for you guys about the writtenness of the show. I listen to a lot of podcasts and obviously am on one, but almost all of them are in the nonfiction podcast world, and almost all of them also are made up as they go along. They're either in interview format or they might be comedy improv based on an idea, but your show seems thoroughly scripted from beginning to end. So I had a few questions about that. First of all, whether Cecil or the other voice actors either contribute any improv or whether you incorporate some of their ideas into the script. Also, you know, I know you trade off. You each have an episode and then you'll edit the other's episode. So I was interested in your writing process and also what you think about the future of the fiction, the radio drama. Almost at times listening to you, I feel like, you know, when you go on the Wayback Archive and you just go listen to old radio dramas, you know, you're very much in that vein. And I'm just wondering what you think about that.
Sure. No, I mean, it's very much scripted. There's no improv at all. You know, Cecil will do things like, hey, we haven't heard from this character in a while. I'd like to hear something about that, and we might use that. We have had guest writers. Zach Parsons, who's my old coworker from somethingawful.com. I used to write for them. We had Ashley Learman this summer. But, the voice actors so far have been just performing the script. The kind of where their creative input comes from is we don't really direct them. Like Cecil is very much, we send him the scripts and he sends us back recordings. And so he brings a lot in the performance.
So there's no discussion at all or notes about how to deliver a given segment.
Occasionally we'll give like, you know, little stage directions. For instance, I think in a recent one, Jeffrey was like, I think this character should have a Boston accent. But like that is kind of as far as we go. We don't really like if it's something vital to the story or to the flow of what we're doing, we'll mention it. But for the most part, that is Cecil by himself coming up with these performances.
As far as the process, you know, Joseph and I think write very differently when we write things not for Night Vale, but we have a similar sense of humor and a similar sense of the world, and we found very quickly in writing Night Vale that we were able to adapt to each other's style and the universe that was created in the first few episodes that we really co-wrote each episode in the first few. Once the world was established, we found that we could both write pretty comfortably within the world. Even the talented writers that contribute to the show, you know, we still have to, as brilliant as the stuff we get is, we still have to, like, tinker with it a little bit just to make it match Cecil's voice. But we've gotten so comfortable with what that is that I think we work very smoothly together. And
I'm curious to hear you guys talk about how you think about the balance between world building and classic plot development. There's sort of these almost poetic fragments and tantalizing glimpses of parts of a world and characters that might get developed, but there's not a lot in the way of classic, you know, like, oh, that's the obvious love interest, and that's, you know, that's his natural antagonist. They're starting to get developed slowly, but it's very accretive. And I've learned from reading around the show online that, of course, there is sort of a more classic love story that develops later on. Is that something that you guys always wanted to work towards slowly, something that you figured out how to develop further on? How do you think about that balance?
I mean, right from the start, when I sat down with Jeffrey and we had our first talk about it, one of the first things we were talking about is the fact that we can do anything we want. We can go as strange or as poetic as we want, as long as there's strict continuity, as long as the world makes sense to itself, as long as it has these rules that fit. And so that's where kind of the continuity and the world building came from. As for, like, things like a more classic plot, like, yes, we've started to add that more, but ultimately, the thing is, this is an ongoing story. This is an ongoing podcast. You know, like a TV show, it has a certain amount of episodes, and then it's going to end for the season, and so it can tell a story, and it can end. We can't really do that because we're just kind of reporting on this ongoing thing. And so while we have kind of slowly introduced more plot, I think it just, by necessity, it's more about this ongoing life of this community and just the rhythms of that. I think just the format of it has sort of led to it not having a strong single narrative thrust leading to any sort of specific ending.
I found, listening to this for the first few episodes at least, which I guess is before the storylines start to emerge, that I was kind of listening to it as music, and I really loved listening to it that way, and that it, or poetry, you know, that it was sort of just a series of images and sounds, and I didn't really care when or if it coalesced into a narrative at all. I don't know if you've had that response from other listeners, but also the music that you do choose, the weather, as you call it, the musical number that appears toward the end of every episode, is always great music.
One of the things we hear a lot from fans is, I listen to this when I go to sleep. This is a world that I. This is a voice in a world I can relax to.
Well, I would find somehow. It spooky to go to sleep to, but it's very nocturnal. No question about that.
Absolutely. So I think that I think that that's in terms of story and things like that. We definitely approach in the sense that we don't want to. We don't want to limit ourselves to saying, like, every episode needs to push this one plot forward. And so sometimes we will have one of the most popular episodes and that people still talk about a lot is the culmination of the romantic storyline in episode 25. And then in episode 27, we addressed the first date. And then after episode 27, we didn't address the storyline for a couple episodes. We went different directions. The very next episode was about the summer reading program. And we're able to kind of jump around in time because, as Joseph said, it is a we're reporting on the small town. We're reporting the news that's happening.
It's
there.
Like the Spoon River anthology on acid. Is really
sure.
It is.
This is circling back a little bit to kind of the spareness and the world architecture that you created. But I wonder if that has something to do with the crazy fan response. You know, so often there's like a fervent fan response to something like, I don't know, Harry Potter, where there's already a plot that's like zipping along. And, you know, you begin as the movies roll out to get a sense of what the characters look like and this, that, and the other. But there's something so beautiful about the classic radio play where it's just much sparer and it leaves a lot more room for the listener to be part of the duet and part of creating the story in their own minds. I wonder if that's part of why Night Vale was especially fertile for the fan, like, rocket booster that you guys got. I don't know if you guys have theories on that or if that sounds like it makes sense.
It does make sense. I think that I always go back to the fan artists and the fanfic and slash fic writers, you know, to have an audio medium that people can draw their own ideas of what Cecil looks like. And there's a lot of agreement that we've never even described what Cecil looks like, but the fans have sort of, many have agreed that he has a third eye and he has tentacle tattoos as sleeves on his arms. But we've never set out, we've actively avoided giving too much description. I think we've said he's not neither tall nor short. I think there's something about that. I mean, there's vague descriptions of people.
We use descriptions only when they have some sort of joke or story purpose. Yeah. Like if they're, you know, like the neither tall nor short is just sort of a language thing. It's not really about describing the person.
Yeah.
It is something we get asked the most, I think, by fans. Like, you know, I was just in North Carolina doing live shows, and after every live show, Cecil and I did a Q&A with the audience, and every single audience asked about the description and, you know, why aren't we describing people? And my answer is always that it's just – I mean, for me personally, it's not really a stance on anything. It's just I find physical descriptions in writing so boring and irrelevant. I think that a character is who they – you know, what they say and do and how they interact with other characters and, you know, what their hair color is and what kind of clothes they're wearing is so irrelevant to that, that it's just when I'm reading a book, I tend to skim the physical descriptions of characters. And when I'm writing, I just avoid them completely because I just don't find them at all interesting.
Let me throw in my two cents. The thing that I really love is the weather report. I think it's so well done. It's the excuse to have an indie band songs, the song of an indie band played in the episode works incredibly well.
And Steve is just kicking himself that he hasn't figured out a way to do that on our show. All you want to do is tout indie bands all the time.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
For five freaking years, I've looked for
indie
bands.
I feel like we showed you the way. It's just, and now music. And then you like,
boom.
The placement of the music is really great, too. Something about the way it comes at the end, but not the very end. And then you look forward to that little button afterwards.
Right. Yeah. Well, what we tend to use that music for, actually, is it's sort of a replacement for a narrative climax, right? So we kind of have the structure for episodes where things start bad and then they get worse and then they get worse. And then they are the absolute worst. And then we go to weather. And then we come back and everything has somehow been solved during the song.
Yeah.
And then Cecil just kind of gives us a recap on what happened. And so we've actually – it's very important to the structure of our narratives generally, the weather, because we tend to use it to replace, you know, where in a TV show they might have a big gun battle. We just go to music and then come back and the problem is solved.
Yeah, it's the all-purpose catharsis solvent. Just throw some music on and you're good.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming in. It was really, really fun talking to you.
Thanks, all of you guys.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, SoundCloud, or in the newly updated WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate GabFest. GabFest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Sally Herships, Chris Wade, and Mike Vorlo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the GabFest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week. Looking out on the substitute, still